Well, good evening, and welcome to the third presentation in this, our sixth series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. And my name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the gray hair outside, collecting the numbers here, Peggy Wright, with assistance from our website guru, Hai Long Wan, and Brian Kutz, our reference coordinator. Our technical specialist tonight is Eric Fisher from the WLPS office. Our speaker was born and raised in San Diego County, where his family operated a Chinese restaurant. He tells me still operates a Chinese restaurant for more than 28 years. His mother hailed from Washington State. His father was a native of China who fled to the U.S. in 1949. He lived for many years in Los Angeles, where he earned a bachelor's, master's at California State University before moving to Indiana University and completing his Master of Fine Arts. Since 2000, he's taught in Cincinnati, Los Angeles, and most recently at the University of Louisville, where he's an assistant professor, and we hope soon to be an associate professor in the English department. His current teaching interests include creative writing, minority literatures, including gay and Asian American writing, and contemporary literature. His fiction, creative nonfiction, and poetry have appeared in such literary magazines as Story, Crazy Horse, Grain, Gulf Coast, Kinesis, Mid-American Review, Salt Hill, Gulf Stream, River City, the Bellingham Review, the Connecticut Review, Indiana Review, and many, many others. His first book of short stories, World-Famous Love Act Stories, was published by Sarah Van Press in Louisville in 2004, and featured a host of memorable characters who confront loneliness in their search for the meaning of life. It won the Mary McCarthy Prize in Short Fiction and the 2005 Asian American Literary Award. His first novel, Lost Men, was published by Random House in 2007 and recently issued in paperback by Three Rivers Press in 2008. The San Francisco Chronicle called his writing exquisite, deceptively plain, deeply felt, and spiritually high. It's our great pleasure to welcome author Brian Leung.
Thank you very much, Brian. I appreciate that. And I'd like to thank the WKU Library for inviting me this evening and Barnes & Noble for giving us the space. That's kind of what I want to talk about tonight. I think that he suggested that this evening maybe you would like for me to share with you more than just giving the standard reading, maybe talk with you a little bit about some ideas about creative writing. You have skilled professors who speak with you every semester about creative writing, so I was trying to think of what it was that I might offer that you haven't heard a million times before. So tonight I thought I would talk a little bit about autobiography and memoir. Not about them, I'm sorry. About those two things in relationship to fiction. Primarily, I'm going to read from my work, not as a cheaply, but just as the illustrative of what I'm talking about. Brian mentioned that in 2005, I won the Asian American Literary Award for this book, World Famous Love Act, which is a short story collection. And it was a big event in New York City, and at the big hall for I forget the name of it, but and you know, the 500 seat theater, and call my name and I go to receive the award. And I look out at the audience and I realize that I'm looking at 500 Asian faces. And so, you know, it wasn't pre-planned, but I just kind of said to him, I know what you're thinking right now. Who is that guy and where's the Chinese guy that wrote the book? But it was kind of a real moment for me because, you know, it's a struggle that I've had, and we talked a little bit, this was a very nice conversation, Catherine and I, and some people at dinner about identity and subject positions that we occupy. It was a nice moment for me because at the end of that, into my acceptance speech, you know, I said to them, you know, I think now winning this award, I can put that struggle away. I have a award that says Asian American Literary Award. Who else are they going to give it to, right? So anytime anybody questions my identity, I just whip out the piece of glass, right? Move back in time. When I was about 8 or 9 years old, living in San Diego, we have the annual fair. They're kind of like the state fair here. It's a livestock fair primarily, and flower show and all that kind of stuff. It's the Del Mar Fair. My dad took me with all my Chinese relatives. That generation only speaks Chinese. We're walking down the Midway, you know, there's the cotton candy, all the American stuff, the corn dogs, you know, the air is full of all those wonderful smells. We're walking down, and I'm with about 8 other relatives, and they're all speaking Chinese to each other. It's just me with them. And at 8 or 9 years old, I suddenly got very, very self-conscious that all these people that are sitting around eating their cotton candy now, they're going to think that I've been kidnapped. troublesome to me, you know. And so I started doing this, which now is so embarrassing to me, but I started, because I don't speak Chinese, I started just randomly going, why are you not able to find me? Why are you not able? So that these people who might be looking at me would see, oh, he's talking to us. There's people, he belongs with them. Well, that gives you maybe some perspective on a range of my cultural identities. I won't, you know, that's only the Chinese side. I won't go into the other side. I guess I can say that when I'm with my mom's side of the family, they perceive me as totally white. My dad's side of the family, they think of me as totally Chinese. My grandma, she died at 101, this is a Chinese grandma. When she was 98, I had a conversation with her that my sister interpreted for me. And one of the questions I asked grandma was, well, grandma, do you think of me as white or do you think of me as Chinese? Oh, my gosh. She never yelled at me before. She just tore me a new one. Excuse me, grandma probably wouldn't like that phrase. But she was just horrified that I would even question my Chinese identity. So, I mean, there was another moment there for me to kind of give me permission to go, yeah, you know, I'm Chinese. Now, what does this have to do with this evening and in creative writing and fiction writing, or creative nonfiction too, for the feedback there? You know, I have some of that. Well, I think that what I thought is, rather than talking about craft or anything like that tonight, you know, what does that biography have to do with any of my creative writing? Or what do any of our subject positions, our biographies, have to do with our creative writing? Why is it relevant? As you might imagine, it's probably the main question I get, and most fiction writers get. Poets maybe don't suffer as much under this because there's an assumption that what poets say they're writing from a personal place. Fiction writers, how much of that is autobiographical? It's not a bad question, but you get it a lot. I think that's because we have a special appreciation, readers have a special appreciation for autobiography and memoir, because there's truth at work there, right? If we read a memoir, we read autobiography, we're reading somebody's real struggle. Somebody really made it through a drug addiction. Somebody really made it through child abuse. It wasn't just a fiction writer's construct. So on that score, I thought I would read to you from just a few pieces. This is from a story called Executing Dexter, and the premise here is there are two young boys, pretty pubescent, kind of displaced in school. They don't really have a group that they hang around with. Grant, the narrator's name is Herschel. Grant is he's a friend that he idolizes. Grant's that guy, that elusive guy in school, who's just, he's beautiful, but he's a loner. He should have more friends than he has, but he just doesn't. So one of their primary activities is that they make infant effigies and find ways to murder them in a funny way. The first baby to go was Veronica, Grant's idea. A 5-pound sack of flour with red felt-tip smile and two googly eyes plucked out of a stuffed giraffe head we found in the Goodwill donation box. We made her in Grant's room, the only place where we had any privacy. My house was out. Even though in those days my mother was just an echo in my life, always doing something besides being home, and my father expected me to read or practice for a recital. There was always a recital. I stayed out until nearly 5 o'clock when I knew my father came home from school. I was supposed to spend that time doing something constructive, but I knew I'd be locked down once he got home and there'd be plenty of time, too much time, in our quiet house. But Grant lived in the Pink Ghetto, a low-rent apartment complex coated with stucco the color of chewed bubblegum. His room was safe to build babies. His stepfather, Grant called him Dude, had two jobs, one as a bouncer at a local cowboy bar, the other selling gas. So he was rarely home, and Grant's mother never bothered us because she had to lie flat during the last 3 months of her pregnancy. At first, I never saw her face, just her creamy white feet beyond the half-open door. Hello, Herschel, the feet said the day we finished Veronica. You boys behaving? I looked directly at those feet as one scratched the other with its big, saucer-shaped toenails. Yes, Mrs. Pope. Veronica lay peacefully on Grant's floor, waiting to be dressed. I wish she'd hurry up and have that stupid baby. Grant said as he slipped one of his old t-shirts over Veronica's square body. I hate being quiet all the time. I don't know why the dude doesn't just let her get pregnant anyway. I sat Veronica up and held her for Grant's inspection. He frowned, handing me some markers. You can't hurry a baby, I said. They gotta eat and stuff before they come out. I plunked her red, cupid mouth and filled in bill-like lashes over Veronica's loopy eyes, her black plastic pupils swirling with each jostle. What do you think they eat while they're inside, Grant asked. I paused. When he wasn't the expert, I took the opportunity to show him I knew something. Milk, I said, looking around the room. The best thing about being in Grant's was his posters. Every wall was a pipeline wave with a surfer crouched and peering out. My favorite was the blonde guy with the green eyes that Grant said got killed in Hawaii surfing storm waves. But Grant liked the one of Farah, head tilted back, a mane of frosty blonde hair scattered around her face, nipples perked beneath a red one-piece. She's a fox, he said for the 100th time, noticing I was looking at her. And milk comes from boobs, he said, trying to correct me. Oh, well, women got these tubes inside the baby sucks on like a straw. I held up Veronica again, and Grant was satisfied. We discussed how unborn babies ate as we walked to the bridge that stretched across the dry bed of the San Diego River. Following my tube principle, by the time we arrived in the center, we agreed that babies had access to certain foods right after the mother swallowed them. The thought of a baby sucking down chewed spaghetti grossed us both out to the point of laughter. Grant held Veronica over the concrete railing. The air was warm and breezy. 40 feet below us was the sandy riverbed, clotted here and there with bamboo stands. Veronica's indifferent pucker mocked us now, and I didn't feel sorry for her at all as Grant let go, and she turned head first, the t-shirt flailing like a comet tail. She thudded into a big white spray of flower, carnation-like. Not as gruesome as we hoped, but still worth the effort. Little white puffs blew off her like smoke. That's no trick, Grant said. She's dead and on fire. Well, there was no Grant. And Herschel in that story is African-American. So the fact that I'm most of that is accurate, does it make the story less true? Are we disappointed that I'm not that boy? But my time has been better spent talking about how I grew up in that town as a boy. How about this one? This is called Good Company. Maddie's the name of the character here. She's in her late 60s. When those African hands appeared in front of me about a week ago, you might think I would have been scared. But I wasn't, not for a second. I woke up that morning and there they were above my bed, kind of prayer-like, and attached to nothing but air. They were sugary brown and waxy like they'd worked hard for a lot of years. And when they opened, the palms were pinkish tan and dark brown in all the creases. I reached up to touch them, but it was like there was nothing to touch. So I left my hand there for a second to compare. Mine are ivory gray, and practically the only thing that was the same were our white beveled fingernails. So far, they haven't done much except follow me around, but I know they'll do something. I have this meeting here at my diner, and people expect me to talk, and I don't have any idea what I'm going to do to convince them. Maybe they'll be the most important words I'll ever speak, so I figure those hands will pitch in somehow. But like I say, they haven't done anything for a week but float. Right now, it feels pretty much like I'm alone in all this. Then again, I've gotten kind of used to that over the years. Not that I wouldn't prefer someone at my side now and then. I can't be worrying about having some company or what those hands are going to do, especially when this whole place is about to be packed with people wanting free biscuits. It isn't as easy as it used to be either. I make them from scratch, and that means the mixing and kneading and rolling out, and these naughty old hands of mine have just about given out for that kind of work, which is why I'm nearly covered in flour. But this morning's meeting is very important. I can't recall a time when Blue Falls was in more of a fix than it is right now. All my boys who eat here are mostly loggers and truckers or some such, and Washington State just isn't making those jobs the way they used to. And the rest of us make our living serving them. So it's like what they say about falling dominoes. And now we have Stray Mark and Son to one of come in and buy up the whole street above the river and put in a fancy new hotel, just wipe out blue balls altogether. So that's what I figure those hands come around for. They've been following me since the moment I got out of bed a week ago, and they haven't stopped. Even this morning when I was showering, but they never steamed up or got wet, just sat over my shoulder, and I can only barely reach around to wash my own back anymore, and maybe could have used some help, but I didn't say anything. Then, like every morning for the last week, they followed me to work all the way down Sturgeon Road, even though sometimes it was hard to tell. There isn't much light at 3 a.m. except maybe the moon, but they were there the whole time, moving and praying. I started to think it was an angel, but if God sent me one of those, why didn't he send me something that talked? Though I suppose a pair of floating hands is a lot easier to take than a pair of floating lips.
You vote for the hands over the lips.
I have not had the floating hands hallucination, or I don't know, I guess in that story it's not hallucination, right? She's real. I kind of thought about maybe my grandma writing that story, or my Aunt Lee, who are all from Missouri, but I don't have that personal experience. They're probably far more qualified than me to talk about what it means, you know, what the interior is of a woman who's in her late 60s. Should I say they're probably more qualified? You know, they're technically more qualified is what I should say. They've had that experience, right? And we oftentimes, when we teach creative writing, we tell students to write what you know. And in these first two stories, I'm not writing what I know. You know, I'm interested in what I don't know in those two stories. And is that okay? Maybe I should just write about being half Chinese. You know, here's the story. Many of us in here are not of age to kind of remember this time, but in the late 80s and in the early 90s, gay men were, you know, it's kind of history now, but gay men were like dropping like flies in California, particularly in New York, big cities. You know the history of AIDS. Well, you know, for those of us who were living in Southern California, San Francisco, New York, those things were a reality. I mean, you were just hearing about suddenly all these people falling away. I curiously did not have that experience. I was living there. I saw it on the news. I am gay. I had 3/4 of my friends were gay, but I wasn't seeing all that. I watched Philadelphia. You know, like, that was, you know, that counts, you know, like seeing nothing that way, you know. So that was the era, too, in gay literature of, you know, the big grand AIDS story, the big operatic story. That's what, if you look at Philadelphia, that's kind of what that is. So here's a story called Firewalk, an old-fashioned AIDS story. And I'm not going to read the whole story. I'm going to spoil it for you for anyone who cares. No, it's not over here, so I'm not going to spoil it for you. I'm reading the ending here and putting this in the context of autobiography because it bears no relationship to my personal experience. And I wonder if part of autobiography and memoir that fiction writers can borrow from is the emotional experience that you derive out of the cultural experience. You might imagine in the late 80s and early 90s, I had this like massive fear that I was going to be one of them, one of the gone that disappeared. We didn't know what was going on, right? It could be next. So does the truth of this fiction here just match if this was somebody I knew or if this was my personal experience? The character here, and if any of you read the novel, Gideon makes an appearance in the novel more lively than perhaps he is here. Gideon is a middle-aged man living in Los Angeles who finds out or not, he knows that he's dying, and this is the dying moment. He's called his mother, said, come up from San Diego, I'm going, you know, it's over. So he's sitting on his deck in Los Angeles waiting for it. It is this night Gideon thinks of as he sits on his deck waiting for his mother to arrive from San Diego. A pair of jets make paper trail sutures across the sky, scarred healing from their farthest point. He knows that it's 5 o'clock by a specific gradation of yellow. It is the easiest time for him to breathe, looking at the backlit olive trees and Spanish-style homes, the increasing sound of traffic washing insinuation from the air. He realizes he is waiting for that transition which never comes to Los Angeles. People, like certain perennials, coaxed into extended seasons. He examines his hands, convinced he can feel the skin pulling back from his nails. They are dry and peeling in minute strands. Gideon looks at the adjacent hill a mile off, everything behind it a vague petroleum orange. At the top of the hill stands a single palm, a black and accidental keyhole after the sunset. He drove to it once. The tree's base was covered with nails and staples from years of lost dogs and yard sales. It seemed unaffected, its rustling crown of bronze staked and new, making the air sound carbonated. But now, its form is simply dark and distant. Looking out at Los Angeles from his home, he begins to understand the geometry of light. A plane of red dust and halogen shards. It is like a bed of hot coals he has just crossed. A quarter moon sits low in the sky, tinted orange like a dim lantern. The light falls on Gideon's skin like a dying flame. He feels the oncoming night and people like himself making decisions that will change their lives. We are consumed like fuel, he thinks, and we are cautious because every twilight is a firewalk. He considers the intricate process of preparation and how he will be remembered. They will say he was successful. He had a career and a house with a view. But it has all come down to reversion, as if he has recreated an expectant mother waiting for his birth. I have relinquished myself, Gideon thinks. He had counted on his life's momentum, and now it is leaving him as he sits alone on the deck of his backyard. He accepts the conditions of this final inertia, the feeling he is slipping, falling back, and he hopes his mother will arrive in time to catch him. Gideon's alive in the novel, right? So, is that disappointing? There are other characters in that short story collection. There's an adult, there's a Chinese porn actress that wears, famous for wearing blonde wigs, and there's a Chinese chicken farmer, and there's a gay couple that takes a big, egg rancher, excuse me, I've got to get that right. There's a gay couple that takes a trip, a road trip, and they end up in New Orleans, and there's a world-famous archaeologist, none of whom are me. I wonder if my time would have been better spent just writing the Brian story. And for those of you who are writing fiction in here, how much time do you spend on thinking about which stories you should be writing? The you stories or the stories that are outside your subject position? Why aren't you writing your Chinese porn actress story? Or why aren't you writing your African-American elementary school kid? What keeps you from that? Is it because we fear not being authentic? Those stories in that collection are different, and it would be quite a strain to claim that they're autobiographical, but I'd like to claim as fiction that they are fiction. My stories are more true than if I'd written autobiography, because writing autobiography and a memoir have the immense burden of trying to be true, trying to record their lives precisely as those lives happened. But that means that their memories, our memories, have the burden of being perfect. And also the honesty in self-revelation has to be unimpeachable. If you're going to self-reveal, you have to go all the way. Otherwise, it's not true. And I think that those standards are impossible for autobiography and memoir. How could you be wholly true? None of our memories are perfect. So you already know, sitting out, you're about to create an imperfect document when you're working in that form. Fiction, on the other hand, is true every time, because whatever the author creates is the authentic thing. It can't be anything else but that thing. Now, we can get into other issues of truth in terms of fiction about plausibility and those kind of things, but whatever the world creates, the author creates, is true. This isn't to say that in memoir, autobiography, that embellishment or the skillful lie or the exaggeration can't be more interesting than fiction. What was that, James Fry's Million Little Pieces, right? You know, he wrote that as a novel, right? And then marketed it, when it didn't sell as a novel, marketed it as a memoir, right? So it was more interesting, its embellishments. I mean, the fiction was more interesting as memoir, which is really complicated. But this makes me wonder, well, you know, if we're looking for that perfect true world, if we want to write that perfect true world, why not just write fiction? Why do that? I'm gonna share with you a horrifying moment of autobiography in terms of the life of the novel that I'm gonna read from. The novel came out last year, came out in paperback this year, just came out in September. The French translation was really cool. I got to go to this thing called Festival America, which they brought 52 writers from the Americas, North America, South America, and some of the islands, over for
faces on the cover. That is really, really horrifying. Partly because, you know, I really do have this question in my head. First of all, I'm not like everyone. I don't like my own face. But also, I was really uncomfortable because they're putting a face to the character, right? You know, they're making this a piece of autobiography by doing this, right? Or memoir. I mean, it's advertised as a novel, you know, and but this is contributing to the, this is the paratext is what we call this, right? Everything that's outside that isn't the novel itself, everything that comments on the text without commenting on, this is the paratext. And I was really, really troubled by that. That's now, my character's name is Weston, that's now Weston, right? Brian and Weston are the same person now. How could a reader ever have their own experience? The novel is about, largely about a half-Chinese man in his mid-30s. Something about which I know nothing. And the father and son have been, the son was raised Chinese, Weston was raised Chinese up until he was 7 or 8, I guess, and there's an accident, the mother's killed, the father is so distraught by this that he decides that he cannot raise this child anymore. He gives Weston up to his Weston's white relatives who live in Blue Falls. Same Blue Falls that's in the short story collection. So Weston is raised as a white kid. So the father comes back after 25 years, doesn't come back, writes in a letter after 25 years and says, that was a mistake. That was a mistake. I'm sorry. I want to make it up to you. I want to take you to China. The acceptance is reluctant, to say the least. And I'm just going to read a little bit of that for you. And what I thought I would do is that I'm going to do something I probably shouldn't do. I'm going to turn this into a clothing optional evening. The father and son share the chapters here. And normally what I do at a reading is I give you a son chapter, Weston chapter, the father's chapter, so you get a sense of voices. But I'm going to read you a chapter with Weston talking about his mother. So you know the story of the novel. They go on this trip. They do go on this trip. They go on this trip to China, and they try to figure out if they have any kind of relationship left. There's a question of paternity. Weston even wonders whether or not he's actually his father's son. There are other mysteries. And then Weston, you know, well, I won't give you the resolution, but the chapter I'm going to read you here, I'm just reading to you because I think, I am awake in the darkness of our hotel room, my father's puppy breath, the only sound. I've turned Mrs. Chung's box over my hand. It is both solid and soft. Weston has given this box to the child and basically told, at some time, I want you to open this box and you will have answers to your life, but you have to open it at the right time. So he's had this box for, you know, 25 years. I prefer to imagine, perhaps inside is merely a wise Chinese saying on a scrap of paper. I prefer to imagine a bright light expanding into the room when I pull off the lid. Maybe the voice of a god booming a new direction for my life. When I was a boy, my father sometimes played this kind of game with me. One of us closed our eyes while the other placed an object in his hands, leaving him to guess what the object was or to make up some fantastic story about it if he was stumped. My mother, though, wouldn't indulge in playing such childish games with me. My old maid cards were mostly untouched, and chutes and ladders sat ignored in the back of my closet. Instead, when I turned 4 and we were alone, she cleared the kitchen table of its egg-shaped shakers and plastic napkin holder and got out the playing cards. We sat across from each other, and then she shuffled. She always shuffled first. The cards pattered against each other, flipping rapidly between her fingers. She taught me gin, and later when I started coming within 2 or 3 cards of going out, she showed me how to play rummy. What I remember most, though, are the jigsaw puzzles my mother kept in her mahogany-stained roll-top desk and on the card table in our living room, where she put them together. It was a mystery to me that my mother could assemble these fragmented pictures. I didn't understand how she conjured the images of red barns bordered by yellow fields, of gumball machines and harbor scenes, whatever she wanted from the pieces, it seemed. As far as I was concerned, my mother was an artist, a magician. She worked on these puzzles late at night, mostly, when my father and I were long in bed. once I woke up and heard the muffled rattle of the little cardboard pieces. I understood my mother was opening a new box, and I got up to see what she was working on. The living room smelled faintly of bleach, and I knew she was soaking her nurse's uniform. My mother sat in her folding chair, sifting through pieces in the box. She wore her faded blue terry cloth robe, and her blonde hair was down, still kinked from the bobby pins she wore at work. She looked up, holding her arm out to me. "Can't sleep, love?" she asked. I shrugged and scooted in close to her. "What are you making this time?" I pointed to the gray, upended pieces in the box. "Marbles." She held up the cover. From edge to edge, marbles of all colors filled the photo. "Do a truck." My mother laughed at me and squeezed. "It doesn't work that way. I have to put together the picture on the box." I had never considered this rule before, and it bothered me. "Some people start with the edge pieces." She fished around the box and pulled out a piece that was flat on one side. She explained how one could find all these and create the border of the picture. "But that's too easy. I like to find a specific point and build out from there." She pushed her chair back and lifted me onto her lap. "People are fun to start with. Not too many puzzles have them, but when they do, I find their tiny heads or pieces of their body and try to put them together for them first. Then I build the world around them." My mother held up the cover of the box again. "Where should we start?" I considered the different marbles. Most of them shone brightly, solid blues and reds and greens and clear ones with twisted candy cane ribbons of color inside. Finally, I pointed to one that was mostly hidden. Was it yellow? Or was it clear and refracting that color from the marble beneath it? "Tough one," my mother said. She poured half the pieces onto the table and gave me the box containing the rest. "Let's find it." I don't know what time it was or how long this took, the process of finding that exact obscure marble, but the world was dark and quiet except for the single light we used and the heavy tick of our kitchen clock. At some point, my mother brought another chair to the table and made herself coffee. I appreciated the smell because it always meant she was settled in, relaxed. She never made a pot before work or if she had an appointment. It was her way of winding down. The percolator announcing in a sturdy way that all was well. My mother finished looking through her half of the puzzle well before me. Her search had come up empty, and we both stared at my curvy pile of pieces. Buried in there was a fragment, an image of something itself buried. I couldn't help feeling that it was a lost thing, huddled and waiting for me. I continued more intently now, but my mother didn't intrude. She sat quietly and watched as I inspected each piece. Sometimes I held the more promising ones up to the box. After I had gone through every piece, I looked at my mother. How had I missed the one we were looking for? "What do we do now?" I asked. "We try again, love." She was tired, awake simply for me. She picked up the box and put it between us. "What should we look for exactly?" I considered the picture for a moment, the field of round glass and the tiny spot we were focusing on. "Maybe it's not all in one piece," I said. My mother smiled at me as if this was a surprise to her, as if this wasn't something she'd probably known from the outset. "So now we look for the marbles that touch ours, and I bet we can put it together." She got up and poured another cup of coffee while I began sorting through the pieces once again. After an hour, we had our start. We looked together at our minuscule progress as if we'd built the Eiffel Tower. My mother ran her fingers through my hair and yawned. "That's a good night's work, love." When I think of the life that followed, I often consider the last puzzle my mother and I worked on together. I was 8 when she brought home the big box containing a 2,000-piece puzzle. It was too large to set up on the card table, so we used our wide kitchen table instead. Our challenge was a boy in the foreground flying a red box kite. My mother wanted to begin with him, but I preferred a different route. We decided to make our starting point the string, a vague white curve diminishing the blue sky. I worked on it after school, and my mother sat down to it after her shift at the hospital. Sometimes in the evening, if my father was out, we sat across from each other at the table and worked together. Our chosen path led us down the string after days to the improbably neat boy wearing a white shirt and red cardigan. Then there was the green hill on which he stood. Everything beyond and above was blue, as if he were perched on the precipice of some attainable horizon. When we were nearing the end, we intentionally waited for each other. On the final evening, after dinner, we sat down to the last 100 pieces of blue, some flecked with red. There was a chunk of sky left to create in the upper right-hand corner, and somewhere in there, a boy's kite. Both of us shared the familiar mixed feelings about finishing a puzzle, approaching the closure of it. "We've been keeping that boy waiting a long time," my mother said. "I wonder if he knows what he's got on the end of that string." I followed the white line from his small hands up into the shiny, wood-grained hole in his universe. What would be the consequence if we decided to leave it this way? In Sunday school, they told us that God had taken 6 days to create the earth. What if he had left something out, decided perhaps not to bring forth light? I asked my mother this. She looked at me calmly and thought for a moment, tucking her hair behind her ear. She leaned forward, shadowing our puzzle. "He did leave something out," she said quietly. My father walked in just then with an offer to take us out to dinner. We left the puzzle for the night nearly complete, not knowing that it would stay that way. The next morning, my mother was struck by a car on her way to work. A few days later, the kitchen table was stacked with casserole dishes and baked goods from relatives. Losing my mother was hard, but I managed by being helpful to my father and sitting with a relative who came to visit us, listening quietly to their grief. I cannot recall what they said. All I really remember is watching that final jigsaw puzzle being crumpled off the table and into its box. My mother and I could have finished it in just a few minutes. A boy connected to an incomplete sky by a thin white string. So that's as close as I can get to the truth. That's memoir. And it's completely fiction. Thank you.
I'm happy to, I think we have about, 10 minutes for questions?
Yes, enough to ask some questions.
I understand that the characters in your short stories, especially, were not drawn necessarily from the truth of your life. And then where do things like that come from about the straws inside the mother? I mean, that's just sort of one of those things that I could never have thought up. So where did you get that, the milk inside the mother thing?
Well, I start asking myself, and that's not a question I ever asked myself. Right, so then I've got two characters, and I'm thinking to myself, well, and I'm remembering how my friends and I kind of talked to each other as if we knew what things were, and so I just took the liberty in that moment of writing what I would have said as a boy, right? So, what is that thing? And then you know, I don't know what my passes were on that, but I was just trying to, how far can I push this to where it seems plausible they would have that conversation. I'm not quite sure that either one of them actually believe it. They're just not sure whether or not the other person knows more than they do, right? I try to give myself, like with the asking hands, right? I try to give myself permission just to imagine anything. It doesn't have to be... There's a story in last year's Best American Short Story. It's a werewolf story. I tell my students, don't write werewolf stories. I love that story, right? Because that writer gave herself permission to write. It's Karen Russell. I don't know if any of you know her. She's got a story, a vampire story, in this year's Best American Short Stories. She gives herself permission to imagine. So, yes, you could think of this. Other questions?
To the extent to your Chinese side of you, I understand. I certainly know this about Korean. I think it covers other Confucian cultures. There is no tradition of writing what we think is memoir. That writers, I mean, there's memoirs of famous people. They publish and they just call it a novel, and it's just patently a memoir.
Right.
Is there any vestige of that in Asian American writing? I mean, I think of even Maxine Helen Kingston. She doesn't think of that as a memoir.
Right. Well, Amy Tan doesn't think of The Joy of Luck Club as a memoir, but when you...
Yes. Right.
Yeah, with short stories though, right? She actually thought it was short stories, and then, but when you hear her talk, or when you did hear her talk about that particular piece, I mean, it was a lot of that came out of her personal experience. But it was fiction. I don't know of a parallel to that. I would say that I would validate that because I've read a lot of 20th century Chinese.
Chinese women writers in translation, not in the original. And you're totally right about that. There's so much of, particularly the short fiction, it follows the Western model of the fiction, but when you read the biographies, it's almost autobiography. I can't answer that in terms of Asian Americans. I think, though, I will say this. My experience is that I'm a member of the Asian American Writers Workshop, and usually first collections of stories very often for Asian Americans are very, very, very closely to their family experiences. I think I can say that pretty safely. Yeah, probably very close to autobiography.
When you write, or when you are thinking of writing in a particular area, are you walking around with a little book and it says, "Ooh, that's fun, I hope to remember that." Many writers that I know, like as personal friends, do that, and they carry a little book, and if they see something that's extraordinary, they jot it down to remember. And where does all of this come from? Because it can't all be family. Are you sitting in a restaurant watching this lady with flour on her hands and observing, or is this entirely imaginative?
The scene that I just read, that's wholly imagined, right? I have put a jigsaw puzzle together. That's wholly imagined. But the central question you have there, I know about half the writers I know actually do the actual notebook thing. I normally have one. I actually have one at the hotel right now. I normally have one, but I don't know that consistent, like 100% of the time carrying around. But I'll give you, just 2 weeks ago, I had my little tiny notebook, and I live across the street from the Kentucky School for the Blind in Louisville, literally across the street. And they were having some of the big event down there, and I was driving up, and there was a car pulling out from their driveway, and it was a clown in full makeup and full outfit. And I was like, wow, they're having an event at the Kentucky School for the Blind, and the clown still got dressed up. And I wasn't like trying to be inappropriate. I was like, well, and I was thinking, like, what could I do with that idea? I had no idea, and I still have, but I wrote it down. I was like, what could I do with that idea? Not to be inappropriate and make fun of blind people, but just like, well, he went to the effort. Like, you know, like, he could have not worn a red nose. You know, like who's going to know? So I wrote that down, and I actually started building it into like a character detail where, and you know, kind of an unpleasant character detail, but that totally came out of my little red notebook that's all tattered, and none of you will do it. You won't do it. And then 20-something plus will hit, and you start realizing that you're not remembering all this stuff. You think you're remembering, and the scrap system doesn't work, right? And then, you know, 10% of you will get the notebook. Or all of you, actually. You're all exceptional.
Tell us what you're working on now as you're constructing novels.
I have a novel under contract with HarperCollins due in February, and I'm doing something that I haven't done before, which is write full-length historical fiction. There was a massacre of Chinese coal miners in 1885 in Wyoming. So I'm not writing about that event, but it's the background event, and it kind of deals with a little bit of miscegenation of my protagonist is a white female coming from this area, this region, who's up there. Her brother's gone to work in the coal mines in Wyoming. And I'm not doing the whole, like, unrequited love thing, you know, not like some romance novel called Indian Love Song or something like that. But I am kind of, like, exploring the idea of two characters who are a Chinese man and this white woman who are attracted to each other in the context of this larger racial conflict. In the late 1800s, in 1882, they had the Chinese Exclusion Act, where basically he said, no more Chinese can come in, they have to go, but we have the coal companies and the railroad companies who needed the labor, so there was kind of this look the other way thing. And so, and what I'm really interested in, I have to say, is when you do the research, it's not white miners killing Chinese miners. They're all immigrants. None of them speak English. Right? It's not how we think now, like, auto workers or, you know, something like that, right? It's like, oh, no, these people are from, like, England and from, like, you know, northern Italy. And, you know, so it's really, 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 really fascinating. And I don't think I'm qualified to write it. But I'm giving it a shot. You know, doing, I've done a lot of research. I've been out to Wyoming, been to San Francisco.
That sort of leads me into the next question, and I was wondering, when you're coming up with a topic, do you research to find a topic, or do you have the topic and then you go to research it? How do these ideas for the basic stories come about in relation to knowing that you're doing some historical research?
Yeah.
So why do you do that?
Yeah, I think it changes for anyone who, probably everyone in here has written fiction or any book, right? Whatever answers you came to, whatever problems you solved in the writing of the previous work, seem not to work for the next one. So, in this case with this novel I'm working on now, I knew about the event, and I got a flash of an idea for a story for the event, but I knew nothing else. So I had to go to Wyoming and spend almost 3 weeks. I had to go to San Francisco and do that research. It was a requirement before I could write anything. I didn't map out a story or anything. I went and did the research first. Stacked and stacked. But like for some of the short stories, the lead story in this is called Six Ways to Jump Off a Bridge. I was in China on the trip, actually the trip that turned out to be this novel, right, with my father, not thinking about anything. We were walking across the bridge, and it was kind of high, and I was like, gosh, I wonder if anybody's jumped off of this. Oh, certainly there must have been somebody who jumped off of this bridge. And I said, well, if one person did, then probably other people did. And then I was like, well, I wonder how many ways there are to jump off a bridge. And so I just said, well, I'm going to come up with it. I wrote it in my China journal. It had nothing to do with that. I said, well, I'm going to come up with six ways to jump off a bridge. Now, this story has nothing in here. Has nothing to do with China. It only had to do with that title. It's called Six Ways to Jump Off a Bridge. So I knew. So that just came out of the title. I just spoke, come up with, and I'll work a story out of that. So it really varies. While that's happening, I just want to thank you all again for having me on.